"Know him?" said Granny Weatherwax. Nanny Ogg knew everyone in Larkra, even the forlorn thing on the bracken. "It's William Scrope from over Slice way," she said. "One of three brothers. He married that Palliard girl, remember? The one with the air-cooled teeth?"
"I hope the poor woman's got some respectable black clothes," said Granny Weatherwax.
"Looks like he's been stabbed," said Nanny.
She turned the body over gently but firmly. Corpses, as such, didn't worry her. Witches generally act as layers out of the dead as well as midwives. There were plenty of people in Larkra for whom Nanny Ogg's face had been the first and last thing they'd ever seen, which had probably made all the bit in the middle seem quite uneventful by comparison.
"Right through," she said. "Stabbed right through. Blimey. Who'd do a thing like that?"
Both the witches turned to look at the stones.
"I don't know what, but I knows where it come from," said Granny.
Now Nanny Ogg could see that the bracken all around the stones was indeed well trodden down and quite brown.
"I'm going to get to the bottom of this," said Granny.
"You'd better not go into—"
"I knows exactly where I should go, thank you."
There were 8 stones in the dancers. 3 of them had names. Granny walked around the ring until she reached the one known as the Piper. She removed a hat pin from among the many that riveted her pointy hat to her hair and held it about 6 inches from the stone. Then she let it go and watched what happened. She went back to Nanny.
"There's still power there," she said. "Not much, but the ring is holding."
"But who'd be daft enough to come up here and dance round the stones?" said Nanny Ogg.
And then, as a treacherous thought drifted across her mind, she added,
"Magrat's been away with us the old time."
"We shall have to find out," said Granny, setting her face in a grim smile. "Now, help me up with the poor man."
Nanny Ogg bent to the task.
"Cough, he's heavy. We could have done with young Magrat up here."
"No, flighty," said Granny Weatherwax, "head easily turned.
Nice girl, though.
But soppy. She thinks you can lead your life as if fairy stories work and folk songs are really true. Not that I don't wish her every happiness."
"Hope she does all right as queen," said Nanny.
"We taught her everything she knows," said Granny Weatherwax.
"Yeah," said Nanny Ogg, as they disappeared into the bracken. "Do you think, maybe—"
"What?"
"Do you think maybe we ought to have taught her everything we know?"
"It'd take too long."
"Yeah, right."
It took a while for letters to get as far as the Arch-Chancellor. The post tended to be picked up from the university gates by anyone who happened to be passing, and then left lying on a shelf somewhere, or used as a pipe lighter or a bookmark, or in the case of the librarian, as bedding. This one had only taken 2 days, and was quite intact, apart from a couple of cup rings and a bananary fingerprint. It arrived on the table, along with the other post, while the faculty were at breakfast. The dean opened it with a spoon.
"Anyone here know where Larkra is?" he said.
"Why?" said Ridcully, looking up sharply. "Some king's getting married and wants us to come."
"Oh, dear. Oh, dear,"
said the lecturer in recent runes. "Some tinpot king gets wed, and he wants us to come."
"It's up in the mountains," said the Arch-Chancellor quietly. "Good trout fishing in those parts, as I recall. My word, Larkra, good grief. Hadn't thought about the place in years. You know there's glacier lakes up there where the fish have never seen a rod. Larkra, yes."
"And it's far too far," said the lecturer in recent runes.
Ridcully wasn't listening.
And there's deer, thousands of head of deer, and elk. Wolves all over the place. Mountain lions, too, I shouldn't wonder. I heard that ice eagles have been seen up there again, too."
His eyes gleamed.
"There's only 6 of them left," he said.
Mustrum Ridcully did a lot for rare species. For one thing, he kept them rare.
"It's the back of beyond," said the dean, "right off the edge of the map."
"Used to stay with my uncle up there in the holidays,"
said Ridcully, his eyes misty with distance.
"Great days I had up there. Great days. The summers up there, and the skies are deeper blue than anywhere else. It's very... and the grass, and..."
He returned abruptly from the landscapes of memory. "Got to go, then," he said. "Duty calls. Head of state getting married. Important occasion. Got to have a few wizards there. Look of the thing. Noblesse oblige." "Well, I'm not going," said the Dean. "It's not natural, the countryside. Far too many trees. Never could stand it." "The bursar could do with an outing," said Ridcully. "Seems a bit jumpy just lately. Can't imagine why." He leaned forward to look along the high table. "Bursar!" The bursar dropped his spoon into his oatmeal. "See what I mean?" said Ridcully. "Bundler nerves the whole time." "I was saying you could do with some fresh air, bursar." He nudged the Dean heavily. "Hope he's not going off his rocker, poor fella," he said, in what he chose to believe was a whisper. "Spends too much time indoors, if you get my drift." The Dean, who went outdoors about once a month, shrugged his shoulders. "I expect you'd like a little time away from the university, eh?" said the Arch-Chancellor, nodding and grimacing madly. "Peace and quiet? Healthy country living?"
I should like that very much, Arch-Chancellor,"
said the bursar, hope rising in his face like an autumn mushroom. "Good man, good man. You shall come with me," said Ridcully, beaming. The bursar's expression froze. "Got to be someone else, too," said Ridcully. "Volunteers, anyone?" The wizards, townies to a man, bent industriously over their food. They always bent industriously over their food in any case, but this time they were doing it to avoid catching Ridcully's eye.
"What about the librarian?"
said the lecturer in recent runes, throwing a random victim to the wolves. There was a sudden babble of relieved agreement.
"Good choice," said the Dean. "Just the thing for him. Countryside, trees, and trees."
"Mountain air,"
said the lecturer in recent runes.
"Yes, he's been looking peaky lately,"
said the reader in invisible writings.
It'd be a real treat for him,"
said the lecturer in recent runes.
"Home away from home, I expect," said the Dean. "Trees all over the place."
They all looked expectantly at the Arch-Chancellor.
He doesn't wear clothes," said Ridcully, "and he goes oog all the time."
"He does wear the old green robe thing," said the Dean.
"Only when he's had a bath." Ridcully rubbed his beard. In fact, he quite liked the librarian, who never argued with him and always kept himself in shape, even if that shape was a pear shape. It was the right shape for an orangutan. The thing about the librarian was that no one noticed he was an orangutan anymore, unless a visitor to the university happened to point it out, in which case someone would say, "Oh yes, some kind of magical accident, wasn't it? Pretty sure it was something like that. 1 minute human, next minute an ape. Funny thing, really. Can't remember what he looked like before. I mean, he must have been human, I suppose. Always thought of him as an ape, really. It's more him." And indeed, it had been an accident among the potent and magical books of the university library that had, as it were, bounced the librarian's genotype down the evolutionary tree and back up a different branch, with the significant difference that now he could hang on to it upside down with his feet.
Oh, all right, said the Arch-Chancellor, but he's got to wear something during the ceremony, if only for the sake of the poor bride.
There was a whimper from the bursar. All the wizards turned towards him. His spoon landed on the floor with a small thud. It was wooden. The wizards had gently prevented him from having metal cutlery, since what was now known as the unfortunate incident at dinner. Gurgled the bursar, trying to push himself away from the table.
"Dried frog pills," said the Arch-Chancellor. "Someone fish him out of his pocket."
The wizards didn't rush this. You could find anything in a wizard's pocket. Peas, unreasonable things with legs, small experimental universes, anything. The reader in invisible writings craned to see what had unglued his colleague.
"Here, look at his porridge," he said.
There was a perfect round depression in the oatmeal.
"Oh dear, another crop circle," said the Dean.
The wizards relaxed.
"Damn things turning up everywhere this year," said the Arch-Chancellor.
He hadn't taken his hat off to eat the meal. This was because it was holding down a poultice of honey and horse manure and a small mouse-powered electrostatic generator he'd got those clever young fellas in the high-energy magic research building to knock together for him. Clever fellas they were. One day he might even understand half of what they were always gabbling on about. In the meantime, he'd keep his hat on.
"Particularly strong, too," said the Dean. "The gardener told me yesterday they're playing Merry Elwood with the cabbages."
"'I thought them things only turned up out in fields and things,' said Ridcully. "'Perfectly normal natural phenomenon.'
"'If there is a suitably high flux level, "'the intercontinuum pressure can probably overcome "'quite a high base reality quotient,'
said the reader in Invisible Writings. "'The conversation stopped. "'Everyone turned to look at this most wretched "'and least senior member of the staff. "'The Arch-Chancellor glowered. "'I don't even want you to begin to start to explain that,' he said. "'You're probably going on about the universe "'being a rubber sheet with weights on it again, right?'
Not exactly a...
And the word quantum is hurrying towards your lips again, said Ridcully.
Well, the...
And continuinuum too, I expect, said Ridcully. The reader in Invisible Writings, a young wizard whose name was Ponder Stibbons, sighed deeply.
No, Arch-Chancellor, I was merely pointing out...
It's not wormholes again, is it? Stibbons gave up. Using a metaphor in front of a man as unimaginative as Ridcully was like a red rag to a bull, was like putting something very annoying in front of someone who was annoyed by it. It was very hard being a reader in Invisible Writings. The study of Invisible Writings was a new discipline made available by the discovery of the bidirectional nature of library space. The thaumic mathematics are complex, but boil down to the fact that all books everywhere affect all other books. This is obvious. Books inspire other books written in the future and cite books written in the past. But the general theory of L-space suggests that in that case the contents of books as yet unwritten can be deduced from books now in existence. There's a special theory as well, but no one bothers with it much because it's self-evidently a load of marsh gas. "'I reckon you'd better come too,' said Ridcully.
"'Me, Arch-Chancellor?'
"'Can't have you... "'skulking around the place inventing millions of other universes "'that are too small to see and all the rest of that continuum stuff,' said Ridcully. "'Anyway, I shall need someone to carry my rods and my crossbow... my stuff,' he corrected himself. "'Stibbons stared at his plate. "'It was no good arguing. "'What he'd really wanted out of life was to spend the next 100 years of it in the university "'eating big meals and not moving much in between them.' He was a plump young man with a complexion the colour of something that lives under a rock. People were always telling him to make something of his life, and that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to make a bed of it.
But Arch-Chancellor, said the lecturer in recent runes, it's still too damn far.
Nonsense, said Ridcully. They've got that new turnpike open all the way to Stowhellit now. Coaches every Wednesday, regular. Bursar! Oh, give him a dried frog pill, someone. Mr. Stibbons, if you could happen to find yourself in this universe for 5 minutes, go and arrange some tickets. There. All sorted out, right? Magrat woke up and knew she wasn't a witch any more. The feeling just crept over her, as part of the normal stock-taking that anybody automatically does in the first seconds of emergence from the pit of dreams. Arms two, legs two, existential dread 58%, randomised guilt 94%, witchcraft level 0. The point was, she couldn't remember ever being anything else. She'd always been a witch. Magrat Garlic, third witch. That was what she was. The soft one. She knew she'd never been much good at it. Oh, she could do some spells and do them quite well, and she was good at herbs, but she wasn't a witch in the bone like the old ones. They made sure she knew it. Well, she'd just have to learn queening. At least she was the only one in Lancre. No one would be looking over her shoulder the whole time saying things like, "You ain't holding that scepter right." Right. Someone had stolen her clothes in the night. She got up in her nightshirt and hopped over the cold flagstones to the door. She was halfway there when it opened of its own accord. She recognised the small dark girl that came in, barely visible behind a stack of linen. Most people in Lancre knew everyone else. "Millie Chillum?" The linen bobbed a curtsy.
"Yes, sir."
Magrat lifted up part of the stack. "It's me, Magrat," she said. "Hello."
"Yes, sir."
Another bob. "What's up with you, Millie?"
"Yes, sir."
Bob, bob. "I said it's me. You don't have to look at me like that."
"Yes, sir."
The nervous bobbing continued.
Magrat found her own knees beginning to jerk in sympathy, but as it were behind the beat, so that as she was bobbing down, she overtook the girl bobbing up.
"If you say yes'm again, it will go very hard with you," she managed as she went past.
Right, Your Majesty,
Faint light began to dawn. "I'm not queen yet, Millie, and you've known me for 20 years, panted Magrat on the way up.
Yes'm. But you're going to be queen, so me ma'am told me I was to be respectful,
said Millie, still curtsying nervously. Oh, well, all right then. Where are my clothes?
Got 'em here, your pre-majesty.
They're not mine. And please stop going up and down all the time. I feel a bit sick.
The king ordered 'em from Stowhellet special, ma'am.
Did he, eh?
How long ago?
Dunno, ma'am.
He knew I was coming home, thought Magrat. How? What's going on here? There was a good deal more lace than Magrat was used to, but that was, as it were, the icing on the cake. Magrat normally wore a simple dress with not much underneath it except Magrat. Ladies of quality couldn't get away with that kind of thing. Millie had been provided with a sort of technical diagram, but it wasn't much help. They studied it for some time.
This is a standard queen outfit, then?
Couldn't say, ma'am. I think His Majesty just sent him a lot of money and said to send you everything.
They spread out the bits on the floor.
Is this the pantoffel?
Outside, on the battlements, the guard changed. In fact, he changed into his gardening apron and went off to hoe the beans. Inside, there was considerable sartorial discussion.
I think you've got it the wrong way up, ma'am. Which bit's the farthingale?
Says here, insert tabby A into slotty B. I can't find slotty B. These are like saddlebags. I'm not wearing these. And this thing?
It's a ruff, ma'am. They're all the rage in Stowhellet, my brother says.
You mean they make people angry? And what's this?
Brocade, I think.
It's like cardboard. Do I have to wear this sort of thing every day?
Don't know, I'm sure, ma'am.
But Verence just trots around in leather gaiters and an old jacket.
Ah, but you're queen. Queens can't do that sort of thing. Everyone knows that, ma'am. It's all right for kings to go wandering around with their arse off out their trousers.
She rammed her hand over her mouth.
It's all right, said Magrat. I'm sure even kings have tops to their legs just like everyone else. Just go on with what you were saying.
Millie had gone bright red.
I mean, queens has got to be ladylike, she managed. The king got books about it, etiquette and stuff.
Magrat surveyed herself critically in the mirror.
It really suits you. You're soon got to be majesty,
said Millie. Magrat turned this way and that.
My hair's a mess, she said after a while.
Please, ma'am, the king said he's having a hairdresser come all the way from Ankh-Morpork, ma'am, for the wedding.
Magrat patted a tress into place. It was beginning to dawn on her that being a queen was a whole new life.
My word, she said. And what happens now?
Dunno, ma'am.
What's the king doing?
Oh, he had breakfast early and buggered off over to Slice to show old Mucklow how to breed his pigs out of a book.
So what do I do? What's my job?
Millie looked puzzled, although this did not involve much of a change in her general expression.
Dunno, ma'am. Reigning, I suppose. Walking around in the garden. Holding court. Doing tapestry. That's very popular among young queens. And then, later on, there's the royal succession.
At the moment, said Magrat firmly, we'll have a go at the tapestry.
Ridcully was having difficulty with the librarian.
I happen to be your arch-chancellor, sir.
Ooh.
You'll like it up there. Fresh air, bags of trees, more woods than you can shake a stick at.
Ooh.
Come down this minute.
Ooh.
The books will be quite safe here during the holidays. Good grief, it's hard enough to get students to come in here at the best of times.
Ooh!
Ridcully glared at the librarian, who was hanging by his toes from the top shelf of Parazoology BA to MN.
"Oh, well," he said, his voice suddenly low and cunning. "It's a great shame in the circumstances. They've got a pretty good library in Lancre Castle, I heard. Well, they call it a library. It's just a lot of old books. Never had a catalogue near 'em, apparently."
"Ooh?
Thousands of books. Someone told me there's incunables, too. Shame, really, you not wanting to see them."
Ridcully's voice could have greased axles.
"Ooh.
But I can see your mind is quite made up, so I shall be going. Farewell."
Ridcully paused outside the library door, counting under his breath. He'd reached 3 when the librarian knuckled through at high speed, caught by the incunables.
"So that'll be 4 tickets, then?" said Ridcully.
Granny Weatherwax set about finding out what had been happening around the stones in her own distinctive way. People underestimate bees. Granny Weatherwax didn't. She had 6 hives of them, and knew, for example, there is no such creature as an individual bee. But there is such a creature as a swarm, whose component cells are just a bit more mobile than those of, say, the common whelk. Swarms see everything and sense a lot more, and they can remember things for years, although their memory tends to be external and built out of wax. A honeycomb is a hive's memory. The placement of egg cells, pollen cells, queen cells, honey cells, different types of honey, are all part of the memory array. And then there are the big fat drones. People think all they do is hang around the hive all year, waiting for those few brief moments when the queen even notices their existence, but that doesn't explain why they've got more sense organs than the roof of the CIA building. Granny didn't really keep bees. She took some old wax every year for candles and the occasional pound of honey that the hives felt they could spare, but mainly she had them for someone to talk to. For the first time since she'd returned home, she went to the hives and stared. Bees were boiling out of the entrances. The thrum of wings filled the normally calm little patch behind the raspberry bushes. Brown bodies zipped through the air like horizontal hail. She wished she knew why. Bees were her one failure. There wasn't a mind in Lancre she couldn't borrow. She could even see the world through the eyes of earthworms. It was largely dark. But a swarm, a mind made up of thousands of mobile parts, was beyond her. It was the toughest test of all. She'd tried over and over again to ride on one, to see the world through 10,000 pairs of multifaceted eyes all at once, and all she'd ever got was a migraine and an inclination to make love to flowers. But you could tell a lot from just watching bees, the activity, the direction, the way the guard bees acted. They were acting extremely worried. So she went for a lie down, as only Granny Weatherwax knew how. Nanny Ogg tried a different way, which didn't have much to do with witchcraft, but did have a lot to do with her general oggishness. She sat for a while in her spotless kitchen, drinking rum and smoking her foul pipe, and staring at the paintings on the wall. They had been done by her youngest grandchildren in 12 shades of mud, most of them of blobby stick figures with the word Gran blobbily blobbed in underneath in muddy blobby letters. In front of her, the cat Grebo, glad to be home again, lay on his back with all 4 paws in the air, doing his celebrated something-found-in-the-gutter impersonation. Finally, Nanny got up and ambled thoughtfully down to Jason Ogg's smithy. A smithy always occupied an important position in the villages, doing the duty of town hall, meeting room, and general clearinghouse for gossip. Several men were lounging around in it now, filling in time between the normal Lancre occupations of poaching and watching the women do the work.
"Jason Ogg, I want a word with you."
The smithy emptied like magic. It was probably something in Nanny Ogg's tone of voice. But Nanny reached out and grabbed one man by the arm as he tried to go past at a sort of stumbling crouch.
"I'm glad I've run into you, Mr. Quarney," she said. "Don't rush off. Store doing all right, is it?"
Lancre's only storekeeper gave her the look a three-legged mouse gives an athletic cat. Nevertheless, he tried.
"Oh, terrible bad. Terrible bad business is right now, Mrs. Ogg."
"Same as normal, eh?"
Mr. Quarney's expression was pleading. He knew he wasn't going to get out without something. He just wanted to know what it was.
"Well, now," said Nanny, "you know the widow Scrope lives over in Slice?"
Quarney's mouth opened.
"She's not a widow," he said. "She..."
"Bet you half a dollar," said Nanny. Quorney's mouth stayed open, and around it the rest of his face recomposed itself in an expression of fascinated horror.
"So, she's to be allowed credit, right, until she gets the farm on its feet,"
said Nanny in the silence. Quorney nodded mutely.
"That goes for the rest of you men listing outside the door," said Nanny, raising her voice. "Dropping a cut of meat on her doorstep once a week wouldn't come amiss, eh? And she'll probably want extra help come harvest. I knows I can depend on you all. Now off you go!"
They ran for it, leaving Nanny Ogg standing triumphantly in the doorway. Jason Ogg looked at her hopelessly, a 15-stone man reduced to a 4-year-old boy.
"Jason?
I've got to do this bit of braising for old—"
"So," said Nanny, ignoring him. "What's been happening in these parts while we've been away, my lad?"
Jason poked at the fire distractedly with an iron bar.
"Oh, well, us had a big whirlwind on Ogg's Watch night, and one of Mother Peason's hens laid the same egg 3 times, and old poor Chick's cow gave birth to a 7-headed snake, and there was a raid of frogs over in Slice."
"Been pretty normal, then," said Nanny Ogg.
She refilled her pipe in a casual but meaningful way.
Very quiet, really," said Jason.
He pulled the bar out of the fire, laid it on the anvil and raised his hammer.
"I'll find out sooner or later, you know," said Nanny Ogg.
Jason didn't turn his head, but his hammer stopped in midair.
"I always does, you know," said Nanny Ogg.
The iron cooled from the colour of fresh straw to bright red.
"You knows you always feels better for telling your old mum," said Nanny Ogg.
The iron cooled from red to spitting black, but Jason, used all day to the searing heat of a forge, seemed to be uncomfortably warm.
"I should beat it up before it gets cold," said Nanny Ogg.
"It weren't my fault, mum. How could I stop 'em?"
Nanny sat back in the chair, smiling happily.
"What them would these be, my son?"
"That young Diamanda, and that Perdita, and that girl with the red hair from over in Badass, and them others. I says to old Peason, I says, you'd have something to say. I told them Mistress Weatherwax'd get her nick would definitely be sarcastic when she found out," said Jason. "But they just laughs. They said they could teach themselves witching."
Nanny nodded. Actually, they were quite right. You could teach yourself witchcraft, but both the teacher and the pupil had to be the right kind of person.
"Diamanda," she said. "Don't recall the name."
"Really, she's Lucy Tockley," said Jason. "She says Diamanda is more witchy."
"Oh, the one that wears the big floppy felt hat?"
"Yes, mum."
"She's the one that paints her nails black, too?"
"Yes, mum."
"Old Tockley sent her off to school, didn't he?"
"Yes, mum. She came back while you was gone."
"Oh."
Nanny Ogg lit her pipe from the forge. Floppy hat and black nails and education. Oh, dear.
"How many of these girls are there, then?" she said.
About half a dozen. "But them good at it, mum."
"Yeah?
And it ain't as if they've been doing anything bad."
Nanny Ogg stared reflectively at the glow in the forge. There was a bottomless quality to Nanny Ogg's silences, and also a certain directional component. Jason was quite clear that the silence was being aimed at him. He always fell for it. He tried to fill it up.
And that Diamanda's been properly educated," he said. "She knows some lovely words."
Silence.
"And I know you've always said there weren't enough young girls interested in learning witching these days," said Jason.
He removed the iron bar and hit it a few times for the look of the thing. More silence flowed in Jason's direction.
"There goes up and dances in the mountains every full moon."
Nanny Ogg removed her pipe and inspected the bowl carefully.
"People do say," said Jason, lowering his voice, "that they dances in the altogether."
"Altogether what?"
said Nanny Ogg.
"You know, mum, in the nude."
"Cool. There's a thing. Anyone see where they go?"
"Nah, Weaver the Thatcher says they always give him the slip."
"Jason?"
"Yes, mum."
"They been dancing round the stones?"
Jason hit his thumb.